This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Only Investment Guide You'll Ever Need by Andrew Tobias, narrated by Mike Chamberlain. Preface. If it is brassy to title a book The Only Investment Guide You'll Ever Need, it's downright brazen to revise it. Yet not to do so every few years would be worse, partly because so many of the particulars change, and partly because so many people, against all reason, continue to buy it. In the 38 years since this book first appeared, the world has spun into high gear. Back then, there were no home equity loans, no 401k retirement plans or Roth IRAs, no variable annuities to avoid, or index funds to applaud, or adjustable rate mortgages to consider. No ETFs, no 529 education funds, no frequent flyer miles. Oh no! No internet. Can you imagine? No internet? Not even an eBay, Craigslist, or Amazon. How did anyone ever buy anything? The largest mutual fund family offered a choice of 15 different funds. Today, hundreds. Stock prices were quoted in fractions, and New York Stock Exchange volume averaged 25 million shares a day. Today, 3 billion shares would be a slow day. The top federal income tax bracket was 70%. The basics of personal finance haven't changed. They never do. There are still just a relatively few common sense things you need to know about your money. But the welter of investment choices and the thicket of jargon and pitches have grown a great deal more dense. Perhaps this book can be your machete. The Big Picture. Not long after this book first appeared in 1978, the U.S. financial tide ebbed. Stock and bond prices hit rock bottom, the result of sky-high inflation and interest rates, and so did our national debt, relative to the size of the economy as a whole. Investing over the next 3 decades, as difficult as it surely seemed at times, was actually deceptively easy, as the tide just kept coming in. Now we're in, roughly, vaguely, the opposite situation. Very low inflation, very low interest rates, and an uncomfortably high national debt, making the years ahead a particular challenge. Understanding that challenge, seeing the big picture, will help you put events and decisions in context. Take a minute to consider the national debt and interest rates, then another minute to consider the good stuff. National debt. In 1980, the national debt, which had peaked at 121% of gross domestic product in 1946 as a consequence of the need to borrow whatever it took to win World War II, had been worked back down to 30%. It's not that we repaid any of it, just that the economy gradually grew to dwarf it. Whether for a family or a business or, in this case, a nation, having a low debt ratio is healthy. It gives you wiggle room if you ever run into trouble, like a recession, and need to borrow. Indeed, that had long been the big idea, that in bad times, governments should lean into the wind and run deficits, borrowing to boost demand and ease the pain while excess business inventories were gradually worked down, and then, in good times, not borrow much or even run a surplus to build borrowing capacity back up. Yet in the mostly good years since 1980, our national debt has ballooned. From 30%, when the Reagan-Bush team took over, it topped 100% in the fiscal year George W. Bush passed it on to his successor. Only between Bush Sr. and Jr. was the annual deficit tamed, as Clinton handed off what Fortune called surpluses as far as the eye could see. Although the deficit has once again been tamed as of this writing, meaning that the national debt is once again growing more slowly than the economy as a whole, the wiggle room is largely gone. I wrote in this space 5 years ago, with the unemployment rate hovering just under 10% and home foreclosure rates peaking, "We will get through this and emerge more prosperous than ever. But the decade ahead will be more about hunkering down and retooling than about jet skis and champagne." And indeed, the unemployment rate has fallen to 5% as I write this in early 2016. Foreclosures are running at their lowest rate since 2007, and the stock market is more than double its March 2009 low. So we did get through it. Even so, the nation's infrastructure has been allowed to decay badly. The national debt may require 35 years to shrink back to 30% of GDP, as it gradually did in the 35 years following World War II. And many of the new jobs don't pay nearly as well as the ones they've replaced. So it's still too soon for the champagne. Interest rates. In 1981, Uncle Sam said, "Lend me $1,000 for 2 years, and I'll pay you $336 in interest." In early 2016, Uncle Sam was saying, "Lend me that same $1,000, and I'll pay you $20. And people were rushing to take it. So it is a very different world. In 1981, investors willing to take a risk on stocks or long-term bonds knew that, if inflation didn't spin entirely out of control, interest rates would eventually fall, making the prices of both stocks and bonds rise. In 2016, investors have to understand that, whatever may come first, interest rates eventually will rise, making bond prices fall and stocks relatively less attractive as well. The more interest you can get from safe bonds, the less reason to take a risk with stocks. None of this is to say stocks can't go up if interest rates do. They absolutely can if rates don't go too high and sit atop healthy economic growth. But as a general rule, falling rates boost profits and stock prices. And for nearly 35 years, long-term interest rates generally were falling. Wind beneath the market's sails. At this point, if rates were to start falling again in any major way, it would only be because economic conditions are terrible, and that's not likely to drive enthusiasm for stocks. So either way, up or down, we face a bit of a headwind. The good stuff. For all our problems, there is the astonishing onrush of technology. People look at the last 50 years of technological progress and they are dazzled. And they think to themselves, the next 50 years may be equally dazzling. Won't that be something? But no, says futurist Ray Kurzweil, they are wrong. Technological progress over the next 50 years will not be equally dazzling. It will be 32 times as dazzling, 32 times as fast, 32 times as great. The implications are both thrilling and scary. Cyber terrorism? Don't get me started. There's no guarantee that, whether as a nation or a species, we'll keep from hurtling off the rails. That is, indeed, the central challenge of the century. But if we can manage to keep from blowing it, the implications are amazing. Imagine, for example, a world of nearly free, clean, renewable energy, much as we now have nearly free communications. When I was a kid, a hushed, urgent, "I'm on long distance," meant get the hell away from the phone. And that was for a call to Chicago. Today, the same call, even if it's to China, and even if it's a video call, is nearly free. Nearly free energy would make everything dramatically less expensive, including materials like energy-intensive aluminum, allowing most people to enjoy a terrific boost in their standard of living. And that's just energy. The rate of advance in medical technology is another thing, already dazzling, that's likely to speed up, with astonishing implications. It's getting from here to there that is the challenge. At best, it will be a bumpy ride. But making sensible economic and financial choices and getting into sensible habits will at the very least tilt the odds in your favor to enjoy as much of the upside as possible while avoiding the pitfalls. Okay, let's get started. Part 1. Minimal risk. There is no dignity quite so impressive, and no independence quite so important, as living within your means. Calvin Coolidge. 1. If I'm so smart, how come this book won't make you rich? You have to watch out for the railroad analyst who can tell you the number of ties between New York and Chicago, but not when to sell Penn Central. Nicholas Thorndike. Here you are, having just purchased a fat little investment guide we'll call Dollars and Cents, as so many investment guides are, although the one I have in mind had a different title, and you are skimming through idea after idea, growing increasingly excited by all the exclamation marks, looking for an investment you would feel comfortable with. You page through antique cars, raw land, mutual funds, gold, and you come upon the section on savings banks. Mexican savings banks. The book explains how by converting your dollars to pesos, you can earn 12% on your savings in Mexico instead of 5.5% here. At 12% after 20 years, $1,000 will grow not to a paltry $2,917, as it would at 5.5%, but to nearly $10,000. What's more, the book explains, U.S. savings banks report interest payments to the Internal Revenue Service. Mexican banks guarantee not to. Wink. The book does warn that if the peso were devalued relative to the dollar, your nest egg would shrink proportionately. But, the author reassures, the peso is one of the stablest currencies in the world, having been pegged at a fixed rate to the dollar for 21 years, and the Mexican government has repeatedly stated its intention not to devalue. Now, how the heck are you, who needed to buy a book to tell you about this in the first place, supposed to evaluate the stability of the Mexican peso? You can only assume that the author would not have devoted 2 pages to the opportunity if he thought it was a poor risk to take. And he's an expert. Anyone who writes a book, I'm pleased to report, is an expert. And, as a matter of fact, you do remember reading somewhere that Mexico has oil. Pretty good collateral to back any nation's currency. Anyway, what would be so dreadful if, as your savings were doubling and tripling south of the border, the peso were devalued 5% or 10%? So, scared of the stock market and impressed by the author's credentials, you take El Plunge. And for 18 months, you are getting all the girls. Because while others are pointing lamely to the free clock radios they got with their new 5.5% savings accounts, you are talking Mexican pesos at 12%. Come September, and Mexico announces that its peso is no longer fixed at the rate of 12.5 to the dollar, but will instead be allowed to float. Overnight, it floats 25% lower, and in a matter of days, it is down 40%. Whammo! Reports the New York Times, devaluation is expected to produce serious immediate difficulties, most conspicuously in heavy losses for Americans who have for years been investing dollars in high-interest peso notes. How much is involved? Oh, just $6 or $8 billion. You are devastated. But you were not born yesterday. At least you will not be so foolish as to join the panic to withdraw your funds. You may have bought at the top, but you'll be damned if you'll sell at the bottom. The peso could recover somewhat. Even if it doesn't, what's lost is lost. There's no point taking your diminished capital out of an account that pays 12% so you can get 5.5% in the United States. Then sure enough, in less than 2 weeks, the float is ended, and the Mexican government informally repegs the peso to the dollar. Only now 1 peso is worth a nickel, where 2 weeks ago it was worth 8 cents. You may not know much about international finance. Who does? But you know enough to sense that, like a major house cleaning, this 40% devaluation in Mexico's currency ought to hold it for a long, long time. In fact, you tell friends, for your own peace of mind, you're just as glad they did it all at once rather than nibbling you to death. And then 6 weeks later, the peso is floated again and slips from a nickel to less than 4 cents. Since Labor Day, you're down 52%. Aren't you glad you bought that book? Everything changes and nothing changes. That was 1976. In 1982, the peso was devalued again by 80%. By mid-2010, it was back to its 1976 value of 8 cents, but only because 3 zeros had been lopped off the currency in 1993. 1,000 pesos purchased in 1976 for $80 and kept in a mattress, albeit an unlikely repository, would 34 years later have become 1 new peso worth 8 cents. And now, in 2016, just 6. This immodestly titled book, the title was the publisher's idea, in a weak moment I went along, is for people who have gotten burned getting rich quick before. It is the only investment guide you will ever need, not because it will make you rich beyond any further need for money, which it won't, but because most investment guides you don't need. The ones that hold out the promise of riches are frauds. The ones that deal with strategies in commodities or gold are too narrow. They tell you how you might play a particular game, but not whether to be playing the game at all. The ones that are encyclopedic, with a chapter on everything, leave you pretty much where you were to begin with, trying to choose from a myriad of competing alternatives. I hasten to add that, while this may be the only investment guide you will ever need, it is by no means the only investment guide that's any good. But, sadly, reading 3 good investment guides instead of 1 will surely not triple, and probably not even improve, your investment results. The odd thing about investing, the frustrating thing, is that it is not like cooking or playing chess or much of anything else. The more cookbooks you read and pot roasts you prepare, the better the cook, within limits, you are likely to become. The more chess books you read and gambits you learn, the more opponents, within limits, you are likely to outwit. But when it comes to investing, all these ordinarily admirable attributes, trying hard, learning a lot, becoming intrigued, may be of little help or actually work against you. It has been amply demonstrated, as I will document further on, that a monkey with a handful of darts will do about as well at choosing stocks as most highly paid professional money managers. Show me a monkey that can make a decent veal parmesan. If a monkey can invest as well as a professional, or nearly so, it stands to reason that you can too. It further stands to reason that, unless you get a kick out of it, you needn't spend a great deal of time reading investment guides, especially long ones. Indeed, the chief virtue of this one, although I hope not, may be its brevity. This one is about the forest, not the trees. Because if you can find the right forest, the right overall investment outlook, you shouldn't have to worry much about the trees. Accordingly, this book will summarily dismiss investment fields that some people spend lifetimes wandering around in. For example, it is a fact that 90% or more of the people who play the commodities game get burned. I submit that you have now heard all you ever need to hear about commodities, or at least about playing with them. In the last chapter, I will offer a prudent way to use a broad-based commodities fund to increase your diversification and decrease your overall portfolio risk. This thing about the forest and the trees, about one's degree of perspective, bears further comment, particularly as for many of us, it is second nature to feel guilty if we take the easy way out of a given situation. If, for example, We read the fly leaf and first and last chapters of a book to get its thrust, instead of every plodding word. I raise this not only because it could save you many hundreds of hours stewing over investments that will do just as well unstewed, but also because it leads into the story of the greatest moment of my life. The greatest moment of my life occurred in the decision analysis class at Harvard Business School. Harvard Business School uses the case method to impart its wisdom, which, on a practical level, means preparing 3 or 4 cases a night for the following day's classroom analysis. Typically, each case sets forth an enormous garbage dump of data, from which each student is supposed to determine how the hero or heroine of the case, inevitably an embattled division manager or CEO, should ideally act. Typically, too, I could not bring myself to prepare the cases very thoroughly. The format of the classroom discussion was that 75 of us would be seated in a semicircle with name cards in front of us, like United Nations delegates, and the professor would select, without warning, whomever he thought he could most thoroughly embarrass to take the first 5 or 10 minutes, solo, to present his or her analysis of the case. Then everyone else could chime in for the rest of the hour. On one such occasion, we had been asked to prepare a case, the nub of which was, what price should XYZ Company set for its sprockets? Not coincidentally, we had also been presented with a textbook chapter containing some elaborate number-crunching way to determine such things. The theory behind it was simple enough. Charge the price that will make you the most money. But the actual calculations, had one been of a mind to do them, were extremely time-consuming. This was just before pocket calculators reached the market. The professor, a delightful but devious man, noting the conspicuous absence of paperwork by my station, had the out-and-out malevolence to call on me to lead off the discussion. I should note that this occurred early in the term, before much ice had been broken and while everyone was still taking life very seriously. My instinct was to say, with contrition, "I'm sorry, sir, I'm not prepared." A considerable indignity. But in a rare moment of inspiration, I decided to concoct a bluff, however lame. And here is where we get, at last, to the forest and the trees. Said I, "Well, sir, this case obviously was meant to get us to work through the elaborate formula we were given to determine pricing. But I didn't do any of that. The case said that XYZ Company was in a very competitive industry, so I figured it couldn't charge any more for its sprockets than everyone else, if it wanted to sell any. And the case said that the company had all the business that it could handle, so I figured there would be no point in charging less than everyone else either. So I figured they should just keep charging what everybody else was charging, and I didn't do any calculations. Ahem." The professor blew his stack, but not for the reason I had expected. It seems that the whole idea of this case was to have us go round and round for 55 minutes, beating each other over the head with our calculations, and then have the professor show us why the calculations were, in this case, irrelevant. Instead, the class was dismissed 12 minutes after it began, to thunderous applause, I might add, there being nothing left to discuss. Now, let me return to commodities. My broker has, from time to time, tried to interest me in commodities. "John," I ask, "be honest, do you make money in commodities?" "Sometimes," he says. "Of course, sometimes," I say, "but overall, do you make money?" "I'm making money now. I'm up $3,200 on May bellies. Pork bellies, bacon." "But overall, John, if you take all the money you've made, minus your losses, commissions, and taxes, and if you divide that by the number of hours you've spent working on it and worrying about it, what have you been earning an hour?" My broker is no fool. "I'm not going to answer that," he sort of gurgles. It turns out that my broker has made around $5,000 before taxes in 4 years of commodities trading. Without a $10,000 profit once in cotton and a $5,600 profit in soybeans, he would have been massacred, he says. But, of course, That's the whole idea in this game. A lot of little losses, but a few enormous gains. He can't count the number of hours he spent working on and worrying about commodities. He went home short sugar one Friday afternoon after it had closed limit up, meaning that he was betting it would go down, but instead it went up so fast he didn't have time to cover his bet, and now he stood to lose even more than he had wagered, and spent the entire weekend, and his wife's entire weekend, worrying about it. So maybe this very smart broker, with his very smart advisors and their very smart computer, has made $2 or $3 an hour, before taxes, for his effort. And he wants me to play? He wants you to play? If 90% of the people who speculate in commodities lose, and 98% may be a more accurate figure, the question clearly is how to be among the 10% or 2% who win. If it is not just a matter of luck, then it stands to reason that the players who have the best chance are insiders at the huge firms, Hershey, Cargill, General Foods, etc., who have people all over the world reporting to them on the slightest change in the weather, and who have a minute-to-minute feel for the market, whether it be the market for cocoa, wheat, or what have you. You are not such an insider, but those who are would be delighted to have you sit down at the table and play with them. If, on the other hand, it is just luck, then you have just as good a chance as anybody else for the jackpot, and all you're doing is gambling, plain and simple, and paying commission after commission to a broker who, friend or brother-in-law though he may be, cannot bring himself to give you the right advice. He'll give you advice on October broilers, or the frost in Florida, or the technician's report he claims somehow to have seen before anybody else. Gladly. What he won't tell you, or it will cost him dearly if he does, is that you shouldn't be in the game at all. Class dismissed. Similarly, antique cars, wine, autographs, stamps, coins, diamonds, art. For two reasons. First, in each case you are competing against experts. If you happen already to be an expert, then you don't need and won't pay any attention to my advice anyway. Second, what most people fail to point out as they talk of the marvelously steady appreciation of such investments is that, while what you would have to pay for a given lithograph might rise smartly every year, or might not, it's not so easy for the amateur to turn around and sell it. Galleries usually take half the retail price as their cut, so a print that cost $500 and appreciated in 5 years to $1,000 retail might bring you all of $500 when you went back to the gallery to sell it. Yes, eBay can narrow the spread and is the preferred way to trade Beanie Babies. But is this investing? Meanwhile, neither print, nor wine, nor diamonds would have been paying you dividends, other than psychic. Indeed, you would have been paying to insure them. I gave a speech to this effect in Australia many years ago, just as the first faint flaws were beginning to appear in what was then a very hot diamond market. Nothing is forever, I suggested, not even the 15% annual appreciation of diamonds. When I finished, a mustachioed gentleman with a bushy head of previously owned hair came up to say how much he agreed with my remarks. Diamonds, he scoffed, and you could see the disgust in his face. And for a minute there, I thought I had met a kindred spirit. Opals, he said. That's where the money is. The fellow, it developed, was an opal salesman. As a child, I collected first-day covers, colorful, specially postmarked envelopes to commemorate the issuance of a new stamp. Sure enough, every year they cost me more and more. Decades later, discovering them in the back of a closet, I called a local collector I had reason to know was on the acquisition trail. I saw his notice on the supermarket bulletin board. Knowing you always do better if you can cut out the middleman, I figured on selling them to him direct. These are beautiful first-day covers we are talking about, from the 40s and 50s, hundreds of them. They had cost anywhere from 25 cents on up, although in those days, so had a week in the country. "How much does your collection weigh?" the buff asked, once I had suitably whetted his interest. "How much does it weigh?" I asked. "Is your collection on a diet?" "It weighs a few pounds, I guess." "I'll give you $25 for it," he said. Checking around, I found this was not an unfair price. Commemorative medallions and so forth, issued ad nauseam as instant collector's items by the Franklin Mint, served to make the original shareholders of the Franklin Mint rich, but are much less likely to do the same for you. Their silver, gold, or platinum content is only a fraction of the selling price. Gold itself pays no interest and costs money to insure. It is a hedge against inflation, all right, and a handy way to buy passage to Liechtenstein, or wherever it is we're all supposed to flee to when the much ballyhooed collapse finally materializes. But if you're looking for an inflation hedge, you might do better with stocks, even a gold stock or two, or real estate. In the long run, they will rise with inflation too, and in the short run, they pay dividends and rent. Broadway shows are fun to invest in, but even if the show you back gets rave reviews, you are likely to lose. A show can linger on Broadway for a year or more, with packed houses on the weekends, and not return its backers a dime. Chain letters never work. Things that look like cosmetics companies but are really chain letters in disguise, where the big money to be made is not in selling cosmetics but in selling franchises to sell franchises to sell cosmetics, don't work either. Things that involve personal salespeople who are full of enthusiasm at the prospect of making you rich don't work. The richer they hope to make you, the faster you should run. There are, in fact, very few ways to get rich quick. Fewer still that are legal. Here's one. Take $5,000, borrow it if you have to, place it on 22 at the nearest roulette table, and win $175,000. Don't laugh. Many complicated schemes, if they were stripped of their trappings and somehow reduced to their underlying odds, would be not much less risky. It's the trappings, the story, the pitch, that obscure the odds and persuade people to ante up the $5,000 they'd never dream of betting at roulette. Anyway, enough of the things that won't do you much good, and on to some things that might. The goal of the next chapter is to save you $1,000 a year, maybe more. 2. A penny saved is 2 pennies earned. I walked home to save bus fare. Gee, you could have saved a lot more by not taking a taxi. Old joke. You are in a higher tax bracket than you think. At least, most people are. And this number, your tax bracket, is critical to understanding your finances. If you earn $40,000 and pay $4,000 in tax, that does not mean you are in the 10% tax bracket, any more than if you earn $240,000 and pay $24,000. On average, you are paying 10% of your income in tax, but that's not what's important. What's important in making financial decisions is how much tax you pay on the margin, on the last few dollars that you earn. Because the income tax is graduated, you pay little tax on the first few dollars you earn, but a lot on the last few. That may average out to 10%. But in that case, if you earned another $1,000 and you're single, nearly a third of it would go straight to the government, $250 in federal income tax and another $76.50 in Social Security tax. And that's your tax bracket, 33%. Unless you happen to be self-employed, add another 7.65%, and or subject to local income taxes as well. Add some more. In New York City, it's not hard to find subway riders, never mind guys in limos, in close to the 50% tax bracket. To figure your own tax bracket, should you be of a mind to, just haul out last year's federal and local tax returns and calculate how much more tax you'd have had to pay if you had earned an extra $1,000. If you'd have had to fork over $350 of this hypothetical $1,000 bonus in taxes, you're in the 35% tax bracket, or thereabouts. Add in sales tax and property taxes, of course, and the bite is even worse. But such taxes, which are not directly tied to what you earn, don't count in figuring your tax bracket. Neither does Social Security tax when making many decisions, since it is not levied on investment income and is not reduced by charitable or other deductions. For the sake of simplicity, even though it's an exaggeration for most people, let us assume you're in the 50% bracket, or not far from it. Do you know what that means? It means that if your boss gave you a $1,000 bonus or raise, you would get to keep $500. It means that time and a half for overtime, since it's all earned on the margin, is not such a posh deal after all. After taxes, it may be no more valuable to you than any other time. It means, above all, that a penny saved, not spent, is 2 pennies earned. Consider, if you are planning to go out for dinner tomorrow night, as you do every Thursday night, for around $50 with a tip, but you ate at home instead for $10, you'd have saved $40. To earn an extra $40, you'd actually have had to earn $80, half for you, half for the tax men. My point is not that we pay too much in taxes. For whatever comfort it may provide, not much, we get off pretty easy relative to the citizens of most other nations. My point, rather, is that when Ben Franklin said, "A penny saved is a penny earned," there was no income tax. There was no Social Security tax. The updated adage would read, "A penny saved is 2 pennies earned," or nearly so. So if you want to pile up a little nest egg, or a big one, the first thing you might consider, even though you've doubtless considered it before, is spending less rather than earning more, which is what this chapter is about. If you're in the 50% tax bracket, it's twice as effective and often easier. Charles Revson, the late cosmetics tycoon, bought his mouthwash by the case. By doing so, although it was the furthest thing from his mind, he did better investment-wise than he ever did in the stock market. In the stock market, with his Revlon-made fortune, Revson perennially blew tens of thousands of dollars on one or another speculation. But on Cepacol, he was making 20% or 30% a year tax-free. He made it two ways. The discount he got for buying the super economy size in bulk, and the discount he got, in effect, by beating inflation. He got a year's worth or two at last year's price. If he had kept the money he spent on Cepacol in a savings account at 5%, for him back then 1.5% after tax, and taken it out bit by bit to buy Cepacol in the one-at-a-time $1.19 size, where would he have been? The lesson is clear, even if you are one of those people with naturally pleasant breath. Say you're a couple who drink one bottle of red wine every Saturday night, and say, to keep the math simple, you go for the fancy stuff, $10 a bottle. Say, finally, your wine shop is like mine. It offers a 10% discount if you buy by the case. What kind of investment return can you earn buying by the case? 10%? No, it's better than that. The old way, you paid out $10 every week. Buying by the case, you lay out $108, $120 for 12 bottles minus the 10% discount. That means tying up an extra $98, but earning a $1 discount on every bottle for doing so. In the course of the year, that comes to $52. That's quite a reward for keeping, at most, an extra $98 tied up throughout the year. It works out to better than a 53% return, tax-free no less, since the IRS doesn't tax you for smart shopping. The goal is not to save $12 on a case of wine, but to do as much of your buying this way as is practical. In the aggregate, it might tie up an extra $1,000, but between beating inflation by buying now and buying in bulk when items are on sale, or getting a buy-the-case discount, you could easily stretch $1,000 to buy $1,400 of the very same stuff you'd have bought in the course of the year anyway. And that's a 40% tax-free return on your money. $400 you've managed to save in the course of the year with no sacrifice whatever. It's not enough to make you rich, but neither is $1,000 in a savings account. This is the chicken-hearted way to play commodities, guaranteed safe for all but compulsive eaters. Forget pork bellies on 10% margin and all those other near surefire ways to get fried. I am long, as of this writing, several cases of Honest Tea, a case of private label bathroom tissue, a virtual lifetime supply of trash can liners, several kegs of Heinz ketchup, and much more. I was short sugar years ago when it ran up to the moon, which is to say I wouldn't buy any. I just ate down my inventory. Wholesale sugar prices subsequently fell from 64 cents back down to 9 cents, and I went long a few pounds. Where to put this mountainous investment? Besides the obvious, like a pantry or basement, if you have such spacious digs, you might also consider stashing your hoard under a bed or table, with a bedspread or tablecloth over the top. I know this is absurd, but I'll bet you can fit 30 cases of staples under just one table. Or make it a bench and put a board over it with a cushion. Water jugs, bouillon cubes, a can opener, don't forget that. Plan your portfolio, which doubles as a disaster hoard, and buy it on sale, in bulk. If you're hoarding tuna, you've obviously got to hoard mayonnaise, too. This idea of a disaster hoard, by the way, is not such a foolish one. Nor is it gloom and doom. Disasters do occur. Floods, earthquakes, power outages. And it does make sense for every household to accumulate, now, when there's no need to, at sale prices, enough non-perishables to last a while. Such a modest stockpiling not only protects individuals, it serves the social interest as well. Just as the nation is stronger if it has strategic stockpiles, so is the social fabric a little less susceptible to disruption or panic if everyone has an added layer of security. Don't tell me about botulism either. Out of 1.43 trillion cans of food sold between 1926 and 1994, when I stopped counting, only 8 produced fatal cases of botulism. Canned food lasts for years, though soda does tend to go flat. And if you rotate your cases of food and drink, the way you used to rotate the sheets on your bed in summer camp, top to bottom, bottom to laundry, fresh one on top, you'll never let anything get too far out of date. If this sort of investment takes up space, it also takes less effort, fewer trips to the store, and you are less likely to run out of things. I don't think there was a day in Charles Revson's life that his breath did not smell medicine fresh. What amazes me is that when I first wrote this, in 1978, almost no one did it. Sure, there were thrifty shoppers and lots of people clipping coupons to get 25 cents off. But there was no Costco or Sam's Club, barely a Walmart, no Trader Joe's or Amazon. By now, who hasn't shopped at one of these places? You? If there's one near you, try it. Anyone can now pay $55 for an annual Costco membership, money back if not satisfied, or $110 for an executive membership that gives you a 2% credit at the end of the year. Pay with a Citibank Costco Visa card, and you can be earning further cash back at the same time. Just don't assume Costco prices are always lowest. Shop around. Herewith, a few more ways to save money. Feel free to skim. Fly now, pay now. The simplest, safest, most sensible way to earn 18% or 20% on your money is to pay off your credit cards. Not having to pay 18% or 20% is as good as earning 18% or 20%. Tax-free, risk-free. It's folly to pay credit card interest if you can possibly avoid it. Still, more than 60% of credit card holders fail to pay them off within the grace period. In fact, many people keep money in a savings account, earning 1% or 2% after tax, if that, at the same time as they are paying 20% to buy on time. They're earning 2 cents on each dollar with their left hand while paying out 20 cents with their right. That's a loss of 18 cents on every dollar. Or, if theirs is a family perpetually $8,000 in hock, $1,440 a year, year after year. Wasted. Credit cards are great for convenience, but terrible for borrowing. Either cut them up if you can't pay on time, or if you can pay on time, make your credit cards pay you. Use cards that give you cash back at the end of the year, or frequent flyer miles, or some other goodie. Check out bankrate.com, cardoffers.com, creditcards.com, and especially, if you fly, milecards.com to find the best deals. Frequent flyer cards give you a mile for each dollar you charge. If you have an American Express card, sign up for their membership rewards program. The miles you earn accumulate in a bank for transfer to your frequent flyer accounts at airlines and hotels. You should have seen me fighting with the sales manager when I bought my last car. He required a deposit and said I could put it on a credit card. So I naturally tried to put the whole thing on the card. An upside-down negotiation ensued, with me trying to give him the biggest possible deposit and him trying to take the smallest. Many people go through life paying 18% extra for everything they charge because they don't pay their cards off on time, and getting nothing back because they use the wrong cards. If you have a $3,000 balance at 19.8% and you pay the required monthly minimum, which with some cards remains as low as 2% of the balance or $15, whichever is greater, it will take 39 years to pay off the loan. Years longer still if you occasionally suffer a $39 late fee. And you'll pay more than $10,000 in interest. Be one of the smart ones who earn 1% or 2% on your cards instead. Fly now, pay less. Especially if you find yourself wanting or needing to take a trip on short notice when the best fares are gone, visit Priceline.com. You just might save $300 at the cost of having to lay over for an hour in Chicago. And you may not even have to do that. Priceline offers the option of booking the specific flight you want at a set price instead of naming your own price. Just remember, no refunds. So if you think you might need to change your plans, try carriers like JetBlue, JetBlue.com or 800-JetBlue, Southwest, Southwest.com or 800-IFLY-SWA, and AirTran, AirTran.com. The one thing not to do with Southwest, or any other airline really, if you can possibly avoid it, is visit a ticket counter. Traveling ticketless with an e-ticket is usually a breeze. Trying to buy, let alone adjust, a ticket at the airport is almost guaranteed to ruin your trip. Among the sites that make fare shopping relatively painless, Kayak.com, FareChase.com, and FareCompare.com. Matrix.itasoftware.com shows you which travel days of the month will be cheapest if you don't care exactly when you go. TheFlightDeal.com is great if you don't care exactly where you go. You just want to pounce on a crazy mistake fare to a place that sounds cool and have an adventure. SkipLagged.com finds cheap hidden city fares where the connecting city is your destination, so you just skip the second leg of the trip. But this is a breach of the ticket contract and may result in your losing your frequent flyer account or other penalties. I'd steer clear. Finally, two tips on the fee airlines charge for changing a non-refundable ticket, which can range from zero on Southwest to several hundred dollars on an international fare. First, if you know 9 months in advance that you're going to either Rio or Paris for Christmas, say, consider buying tickets now to both. Better to spend $569 each for two tickets bought months in advance, knowing that you'll suffer a $250 penalty for changing the one you don't use, bringing the true cost up to $819, than to wait until the last minute and pay $1,540. Likewise, those winter fares down to Florida. Not sure which weekends you'll be able to get away? Consider buying tickets for four weekends now at $269 each, knowing that you'll likely suffer penalties on a couple of them. All four combined could cost less than one would cost if purchased just a few days before you fly. Second, even though it takes a little more effort, it generally makes sense to book two one-way tickets rather than a single round trip. That way, if you need to change the outbound flight, at least the cheap return flight will still be valid. Stay cheap. You can save a fortune through the aforementioned Priceline.com. The only time I don't use Priceline is when I think I may have to change the dates of my trip. Priceline offers no refunds when you name your own price, or when I need to stay at a specific hotel, because that's where the convention is. Otherwise, I specify the city and neighborhood, the number of stars I want, I like four-star hotels, and then bid really low. Many is the time I've stayed in a $300 room for $89. If you're not as spoiled as I am, specify two or three stars. To decide how much to bid, go to Expedia.com, Orbitz.com, or Hotels.com to see what kinds of deals they're offering. Then bid at least 30% less at Priceline. The part I love is where Priceline comes back with a message to the effect of, "Are you kidding?" Hold firm, and minutes later, the room may well be yours. If you do bid too low, Priceline generally makes you wait a day before rebidding, unless you make some change in your request, which is very easy to do. Just add a second neighborhood you'd be willing to consider, or change the number of stars. To become a pro, visit biddingfortravel.com. You'll learn all the tricks of the Priceline trade and see recent prices at which bids have been accepted. Hotwire.com offers excellent hotel deals, like Priceline concealing the hotel name until you've booked it. NewYorkHotel.com represents the Empire Hotel Group. All their hotels have oversized rooms by Manhattan standards and reasonable prices. Though you won't get as good a deal as you would bidding blind through Priceline, you'll know your hotel and be able to cancel without penalties. For the more adventuresome, there are hostels, hostelz.com, couches, couchsurfing.org, and of course, airbnb.com. And if you're not one to plan ahead, try HotelTonight.com for a great last-minute price. Avoid the minibar, room service, or even the hallway Coke machine. Instead, give the next wide-mouth plastic beverage container you empty a permanent spot in your overnight bag, along with a few Crystal Light on-the-go packets. Total weight added to your luggage? Minimal. Homeland security issues? Zero. Neither liquid nor gel. So now you check into your hotel, fill the ice bucket with complimentary ice, empty a Crystal Light packet into the plastic container, add water and ice, shake like crazy, and you've just saved anywhere from $3 to $12, depending on how you travel. The packets themselves run around 33 cents and make the equivalent of two glasses of a cold drink that room service would send up at $4 each, plus service charge, tax, tip, and the time it takes to wait for room service. Over a three-day stay, even if you'd otherwise just go down the hall to use the $1.50 a can vending machine, you save a fortune and avoid having to get dressed again to go down the hall. The nutritional value is questionable, I grant you. But could Crystal Light be any worse for you than soft drinks that corrode car bumpers? Rent cars cheap. If you are going on a long road trip, consider Priceline.com, yet again, for a bargain price rental to spare wear and tear on your own car, and so that in the event of a breakdown, you're not stuck 600 miles from home. Vacation cheap. Priceline lets you build a package where you can see the resort hotel, the flights, and the rental car before you commit to purchase. This may be an appropriate place to mention that I have no connection to or ownership interest in Priceline. And consider lower-cost, alternate locales. For a tropical getaway, Kiplinger's suggests trading Costa Rica for Fiji. For old-world European charm, Budapest for Vienna. Wine tasting, California's Sierra Foothills region over Napa Valley. French cuisine and architecture, Quebec. Don't finance your car. As with credit cards, not paying 5% on a car loan is as good as earning 5%, risk-free, tax-free. Ah, you're thinking. Surely he is not now going to tell me I should pay off my mortgage. And I am not. Although if it was taken out at 7% and 4% mortgages are available to you as you listen to this, why then surely it has crossed your mind to refinance. And even paying down a 4% mortgage is not a bad investment. It's simply the equivalent of a completely safe 4% return. The difference between a house and a car is that a car depreciates, while a house over time may appreciate. Plus, the interest on a mortgage is tax deductible, while the interest on a car loan is not. Can't afford to buy a car for cash? Well, then, buy a used car. It could be really depressing to have to do this. But when it's your decision to reach your goals, that's another story. And it will save you thousands of dollars. That new car smell is the most expensive fragrance in the world. Buy an economical car. If you purchase a car that averages 36 miles to the gallon instead of 18, and if an average gallon of gas over the next few years costs $4, then after having driven 36,000 miles, you'll have saved $4,000 cash on gas alone. What's more, the cars that get the best gas mileage often cost the least. This despite the fact that in terms of their most important feature, getting you where you're going, they are identical to the higher-priced models. By buying an economy car, you save substantially on the purchase price, substantially on your insurance bill. The less expensive the car, the lower the theft and collision premiums, substantially on gas, substantially on maintenance, and substantially on interest if you finance the purchase. In all, the financial decision to be automotively frugal, while it's a decision you have every right not to make, could easily mean as much to you after tax as a $5,000 raise. Resist the temptation to lease. First off, it generally means a new car, so you're paying for that smell. Second, it means financing almost the entire thing, but with a hidden interest rate. Hint, they're not hiding it because it's low. Third, it's just a lot more complicated, with more potential pitfalls, than buying a car outright. If you're a budding salesperson, light on cash, who needs a new car to impress clients and who can deduct the cost for tax purposes, leasing may make sense. In that case, check out LeaseWise at Car Bargains, discussed later. But if you're just driving to work or school or the supermarket, leasing is ordinarily the most expensive way to go. Finance your car, if you must, with a home equity loan. One way to pay off your credit card debt and your car loan is to borrow against the equity in your home, if you own one. Home equity loans are like huge credit cards you can draw on and pay back, in full or in part, as often as you like. They generally carry much lower interest rates than credit cards and somewhat lower rates than car loans. And the interest you pay is generally tax deductible. If you currently pay $3,000 a year in credit card and car loan interest, replacing all that debt with a home equity loan could save you $1,500 between the lower interest rate and the value of the tax deduction. The risk? You'll hock your home and then, credit junkie that you are, run those credit cards right back up again. If this sounds like you, take out the home equity loan, but cut up all your credit cards. And even then, there are risks. What sense is there in taking out a 20-year loan to pay for a 6-year automobile or a 2-week vacation? With nothing forcing you to pay off the loan over the life of the car, it's quite possible you won't. When it comes time to buy a new one, you'll just go deeper into debt. Instead of owning your home free and clear at retirement, you could find yourself mortgaged to the hilt. Wise use of a home equity loan requires self-discipline. If a home equity loan doesn't work for you, perhaps you don't own a home, your best bet will be a credit union loan. If you don't belong to one, your regular bank will often have a better rate than the dealership. Either way, buy the car based on its total price, not by comparing monthly payments. You'd be amazed how many people unwittingly pay $1,000 more than they need to for the car, and perhaps another extra $1,000 in interest, because the 60-month car loan made the payments lower than the 36-month loan. You want to borrow as little as possible, as cheaply as possible, for as short a time as possible. If you do opt for a home equity loan, seek a lender offering no points and minimal upfront fees. That saves a chunk of cash, and you'll have lost less if you ever decide to move or refinance. Don't be fooled by 1.9% financing. When you see one of those deals offering 1.9% financing or $1,500 cash back, take the cash. Otherwise, you're buying a $19,500 car for $21,000, albeit at a good low rate of interest. It's just one more way to lull you into paying more than you should. Haggle, at least when it comes to buying or leasing cars. Among the websites that offer helpful tools and free quotes, autobytel.com, autoweb.com, intellichoice.com, and autos.msn.com. You will only get quotes from dealers who have worked out referral agreements with that website, and if you live in a rural area, you may not even find one of those, but it's worth a shot. Or try carbargains.com, a buying service operated by a nonprofit consumer group. For $200, they solicit bids from at least 5 dealers in your area. Even when the fee is taken into account, Car Bargains frequently wins online comparative shopping tests. They also operate leasewise.com for leases. Or visit the no-haggle buying service at costcoauto.com. Visit Edmunds.com to find out what you should pay or the value of the vehicle in your driveway. Also, Kelley Blue Book, KBB.com. Skip the trade-in. Sure, it's easier just to leave the old car there and drive off in the newly purchased one. Dealers know that and use it to their advantage. If you separate the buying and the selling, you are likely to come out ahead. Your goal: get the best deal you can on the car you buy. Then get a decent deal on the car you sell, perhaps to a neighbor or through the classifieds or Craigslist.com. Drive smoothly. Rapid accelerations are murder on gas mileage. Unnecessary braking converts energy through friction to heat. Good driving habits, properly inflated tires, and a well-tuned engine can save as much as a third of a family's gasoline bill. Beat traffic. That saves gas. The app, as you probably know, is Waze.com. Buy no car. Seriously, if you're a city dweller or live on campus, check out Zipcar.com to see whether it could work for you. You pay $7 a month to borrow cars and pickup trucks for an hourly rate, starting at $8, that includes gas and insurance. Compared with the $9,000 a year you could easily spend on parking, insurance, maintenance, and, of course, car payments, even liberal use of Zipcar could save a fortune. Better still, get chauffeured around. That's what I do. I haven't owned a car in years. Uber.com and Lyft.com are so easy, and in many cities, cheaper than cabs. With never any need to search for parking, get inspected, get repaired, fight tickets, stop for gas, or even remain awake. Text all you like while someone else is driving. When buying auto or homeowner's insurance, shop around. Call GEICO, 800-861-8380, or visit geico.com, among others, for a quote. Progressive Insurance, progressive.com, offers not just its own quote over the phone, 800-288-6776, but in many states, rates for State Farm and two others as well, even when the competition is cheaper. So one call does the work of four. Try also insweb.com. Self-insure by choosing the highest deductible you can comfortably afford. This usually means eating the first $500 or $1,000 of loss yourself, instead of $100 or $250. But unless you're dreadfully unlucky, your savings and premiums over a lifetime will more than cover the extra unreimbursed losses. This is especially true because even people who are fully insured hesitate to hit their insurance companies for small claims, knowing that their rates may rise if they do. Why pay for coverage you may not even use? Generally, there's no point in paying someone else to take a risk that you can afford to take yourself. After all, they're not doing it as a favor. They plan to make a profit even after paying all their overhead, marketing, and sales costs. Why not keep all that yourself? Besides money, you'll save yourself the hassle and aggravation of making claims. The ultimate deductible, of course, if you've bought a ratty old used car, my favorite kind, is to skip collision and theft coverage altogether. Who would steal it? When buying life insurance, it's the same advice. Shop around. There are two basic kinds, term and whole life, also called straight or ordinary or permanent or universal or variable. With term insurance, all you pay for and get is protection. If you die, they pay. With whole life, you are buying a tax-sheltered savings plan as well. Your policy accumulates cash values. Term insurance rates start very low but go up every year. Whole life rates start high but remain constant. Insurance reps are eager to sell whole life policies because their commissions are so much higher. But you would be wiser to buy renewable term insurance and do your savings separately. With a renewable policy, you are assured of continuing coverage even if your health deteriorates. The problems with whole life: many policies pay low interest. It is impossible for a non-expert to tell a good policy from a bad one. There is a tremendous penalty for dropping the policy, as many people do, after just a few years. Most young families can't afford the protection they need if they buy whole life. The same dollars will buy five or six times as much term insurance. In later years, and particularly beyond the age of 50 or 55, term insurance premiums rise rapidly. But by then, you may have a less urgent need for life insurance. The kids may be grown, the mortgage paid off, the pension benefits vested. You will still need to build substantial assets for retirement and to protect your spouse. But there are better ways to save for old age than whole life. To find a good low rate on term life insurance, try